timeout.
In many, many cases, the survival of the guy wire makes the difference between the survival and the non-survival of the radio tower. You can have a zillion tons of concrete under the base of the tower. If the guy wires fail, the tower's going to buckle and fall over. You'd be amazed how many people don't realize that, how important the guy wires are. That's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, when it comes to a guy wire, a tower, a guide mast, as they call it, surviving wind and mistakes that people make. Now, I'm pretty sure Mel had a change of venue. In other words, his normal place that he operates from at the Floyd Bennett Field, which is the Ryan Visitor Center, because the Ryan Visitor Center is being renovated. They had to move down the street to, I think it's called Building 272. So give us a little bit of a description of what the field day site was like from your new location, Mel. K2KEY, KTURIW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening again. This is K2KEY. Well, last year I guess we got sort of spoiled. The Ryan Visitor Center did have this renovated room that we were able to use last year, which was extremely nice because it was air-conditioned and well-lit, carpeted, very comfortable chairs, office-type chairs, many of them in there to make it very easy to set up and comfortable to sit down and, what can I say,
at 8 o'clock.
Great roof with some very high points up there. Some old, the old tower up there on the roof, which was used by the airport, which now was able to support some nice antenna systems that we were able to, of course, install. So, with that in mind, we went over to Building 272, and we said, well, let's see what we can do. They gave a lot of restrictions about antennas, about using the roof, about using tying it off the trees, and all, so many different restrictions, even restrictions about generators. But we managed to sort of be very careful how we ran wires and all, so nothing was really seen unless you looked for it. And hit the generator behind a bush. But overall, it was fairly successful, I'd say, Dick. Over.
Glad to hear that. And I'm sure other people within the sound of my voice either a part of or visited Field Day sites. Why don't you guys give me a call, let us right now, and then we'll call you guys in order and give a little bit of a description of what was Field Day like for you. Was it good for you? So, Field Day Operations, give me your call letters right now. My goodness, everybody's tired. 24 solid hours of operating and they're now sleeping it off. So, nobody else wants to give us a description. Paul, what's going on in space? I think the last we heard from you that there's at least talk. Thank goodness there was talk, for instance, of for quite a period of time, are we going to go back to really repairing Hubble, and finally all of that talk turned into reality, even though Mr. Griffin had previously said we're not going to maintain Hubble anymore, it's too expensive. So we talked about it, and so many people were Hubble huggers, and there was so much of a demand to fix that, even though it's at high risk, that they certainly did a repair operation. I'd like to hear that all those wellness tests are going well, and Hubble's about to go back and take some serious pictures. I'd like to also hear that the cancellation of the space shuttle is going to be delayed so we don't have to don many years of difference between the Constellation system and the Orion system, the new replacement for the space shuttle, and the space shuttle. In other words, the space shuttle was supposed to be cut off in the year 2010. I'd like to believe that's going to be delayed. Let's see if you've got any information on all of the above. WS2N, our space expert, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Dick, could you put me in there for Paul's space report with a question, and here we go.
You're there. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, and Rich, I don't think I'm going to be long, but
didn't have anything really prepared this evening, Dick, but I played around with field day myself, but only at home I operated one Delta. So, with 180 meter dipole, by the way. When I took my trees down, I never put my 20 meter dipole back up, just my 80 meter dipole. I think I'm going to switch over to 40. Anyway, I'm going to do away with 20. Go over with 40. I really like to do that. After all these years operating 20 and 80, time for a change. Everything's really in flux. You know, they haven't picked an administrator yet. There was talk about this one guy who was an astronaut years ago. He's really good at promoting the space industry and all, but I don't know. They talked about him about three weeks ago, and I haven't heard anything about it yet. So Mike Griffin, unfortunately, it looks like he's out. And I don't know if they have anybody in command at all right now. Mike Griffin, he was good, and he was one of the... he was a ham radio operator, which I kind of liked. So I don't know what they're going to do next. As far as an administrator goes, I guess that'll help. You need somebody that's going to sell this to the Obama administration one way or the other. You've got the Hubble repaired. By the way, talked about solar panels. This was the second repair mission. You know, they changed out the solar panels on the Hubble, and they were like half the size, and they put out three times the amount of power or something. Within that period of time when it was developed to when they, you know, when they had the second service mission, they increased the efficiency of the solar cells so much they were able to shrink them in size and, I don't know, I think double power or something. So that's come a long way. Let me drop it. And as far as the shuttle rumors, I heard about a month or so ago, there was talk about extending it to at least 2011 for the shuttle mission. But yet there's no real funding involved. They don't have this momentum money like they had back in the 70s after Apollo. There was so much money involved after Apollo, they called it momentum. That's where you got Skylab from. You got the Voyager missions. There was so much going on and so many people employed, and it just took a long time to put the brakes on the money and the work. And they don't have that this time. So I don't think there's any funding to go 2011, 2012. That would have to be allocated. Now you need an administrator to push for that. So again, that's going to stay the flux. You do have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter on the way to the moon. That's good. That'll go into orbit and fly about 30 miles above the surface, which is half the distance the Apollo command module always orbited at 60 miles above the lunar surface. It's going to be about 30 miles, and that will take really good pictures, better than anything that we have had in the past in a polar orbit, so you'll be able to completely map the moon. Let me drop it. And that's called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. There's another spacecraft attached to that that's going to detach when they get there, and they're going to actually crash that thing into the moon and try to see if there's any water vapor or anything that comes up. They tried this in the past with a mission called Prospector, and at the end of that mission, they crashed into one of the poles, into one of the craters, and had all the telescopes and everything pointing in the direction of the moon, and they thought they were going to see a hydrogen signature from the spectrometers, and they saw nothing. So they're going to give it another shot. Initially, this whole water theory on the moon came from Clementine, It was actually a military mission that went past the moon, and they detected the hydrogen signature. So they've been bent on trying to find this frozen ice mixed in with the regolith, they call it, on the moon for many, many years now. So that should be pretty interesting. I'm not going to hold. Let Rich ask his question. Like I said, I really don't have that much prepared. I'd like to see the Orion mission get underway. I don't want to see any delays with that. They've got hardware they're building and all. I wouldn't want to see anything come to a grinding halt, that's for sure. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Paul, you mentioned the higher efficiency new solar cells that NASA is using. Would you happen to know what percent efficiency or how many watts per square meter? Are there any metrics we know about what kind of power NASA is getting out of their solar cells? What do you call?
I could look that up. In fact, I think Mel has the answer to that. His daughter was giving all the information. I think that was part of the information that he gave out that week of what it was. It increased dramatically after that mission. I remember the one astronaut, Kathy Sullivan, I think it was Kathy Sullivan, or KT they called her, standing at the on the end of the cargo bay, releasing that solar cell that they had disconnected from the Hubble. They wanted to eventually fold it up. They were able to fold one up and bring it back, but they couldn't fold this thing up. So they just let it load off into space. That was some dramatic picture of just letting this big solar cell take off, and eventually it deorbited and burnt up within a short period of time after that. But if you were to compare the size, I think it was one-third. The new ones were one-third the size of the original ones, and I believe twice the amount of power. I do know they were called gallium arsenide cells, so and they were real high-polluting space stuff, you know, like you said before, Dick.
Okay, let's find out. We have access to a space expert that used to live on Dover Street. Her name is Julie. Hey, Mel, do you remember what Julie told you was the power output of those solar cells, or when she calls you the next time, you think you can find that out? K2KEY, K2RIW.
The Hubble telescope cells, yes. I don't remember. I think she said something about it, and I don't know if she's monitoring tonight. If she does, I guess I'll get a call subsequently, so I'll let you know as soon as she calls over.
Very good. We got that long lead item in process. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your question.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. I wanted to revisit that transorbs and varistas. The reason being that I recently did a modification to a Collins power supply that originally used a 5R4 and a 5U4 rectifier, you know, two rectifiers. And in the modification where you go over to solid state, they put a 200 ohm resistor in series with the low voltage 275 volt line to bring the voltage down, to make up the, you know, the difference of what you don't get anymore, the drop in the tube. You're getting a much lower drop. But they tell you specifically to put a varistor across the primary of the power transformer, and they do say to put it after the fuse. You or Glenn, maybe, I'm wondering, why did they put that there? I assume they put it there for transients to keep it from popping the solid-state diodes when you first turn on the supply, I'm guessing. And if I want to go, say, to Mauser Electronics and put a transorb in there, what would I look for, Dick? If I have to put an order into Mauser and I have an account with them.
everyone thinks that the surge that you put a voltage-protecting device on is because of inrush. Inrush current into something really sturdy, like a kilowatt high-voltage power supply with a simple capacitor rectifier network. That inrush current can be huge, and a series resistor is required to protect you from that. On most high-energy transformers, the thing you've got to worry about is not turn on, it's turn off. Opposite of common sense. The inductance of the primary winding of a large power transformer stores a significant amount of energy. You can calculate exactly how much energy it stores. And I did that when it came to the power supply for the kilowatt amplifier, that article that I wrote in the April and May issue. The May issue is at the power supply, May 1972 QST. You'll see the transformer kickback energy absorbing system that's in that power supply. It consists of a diode into a capacitor, a high voltage oil-filled capacitor with a bleeder resistor across of it. So here's how it happens. Because the primary winding of a transformer has got quite a bit of iron to it, and it's got a specific amount of inductance and a certain amount of stored magnetic energy, and because the current in any inductor lags by 90 degrees, the net result is that as Con Ed or LIPA is going through 0 volts, that's the instant of time that the current flowing in the primary winding due to the inductance is maximum. Opposite of common sense. Maximum current occurs very close to the point where it's going through 0 volts. And once you know the inductance of the winding, and you know how many volts you're putting across it, 120 or 240, in your case 117 or whatever because of your three-phase jazz. Anyhow, inductance, you can calculate the inductive reactance, you know what voltage you're applying, you know exactly what the RMS current is. Take 1.414 times that, which is a square root of 2, and you'll know what the peak current is. The peak current occurs...
Repeater, timeout.
The peak current occurs at the instant that the LIPA voltage goes through zero. You know what that peak current is. Stored energy in an inductor calculates to be 1/2 LI squared. L is inductance, I is current. Square the current, multiply it by the inductance, take half of the result. That's the number of joules of stored energy in the magnetic field of that transformer. A joule is a watt second. 1 watt flowing for 1 second is 1 joule of energy. Once you know the magnitude of the energy, and you know that all of the energy wants to come back to you instantaneously at the instant you open the switch. See, when you were connected to LIPA, the exact waveform was being determined by LIPA. You open the switch, and now the transformer is determining the waveform. And he's going to give you an inductive kickback exactly like a Ford spark coil. He can go to any voltage he wants to, only limited by what is the first object that arcs over. That's the only thing that limits the voltage coming back out of the transformer, assuming you've got reasonable thickness of the EI laminations of the transformer. There's a certain limit of the rate at which it can give you voltage rise because of the so-called eddy currents that are flowing through the laminations of the EI core. But that's not much of a protection. Once you know the amount of energy, you can then put a diode network into a filter capacitor. That's what I did on the power supply. And I can calculate exactly how high the voltage will go on the capacitor because in that circumstance, Mother Nature tries to collapse the magnetic field, dump all of the energy into the rectifier and capacitor. Once you know how many joules of energy is being dumped into the capacitor, you calculate exactly what voltage it's going to go to. Now, and you get a bleeder resistor to bleed that off. The one thing that's not so pleasant about all this, let me drop, is that when you build that kind of a protection network that I did, where the kickback goes into a capacitor, the capacitor slowly dissipates it by way of the bleeder resistor, and I think I set it so that it bleeds it off in 1/2 a second or 2 seconds, something like that. If a mischievous child came along and flipped the on-off switch repetitively, and he's storing a little bit more voltage in that capacitor on each event, and he's doing it faster than the bleeder resistor can bleed it off, he, in theory, could create a secondary kind of failure. So that's one approach. You can also buy peak detecting devices, in other words, back-to-back Zener diodes or transorbs or whatever. Once you know the joules of energy, call it ergs if you like. Ergs is a smaller version of a joule. But once you know the joules of energy that has to be dissipated with the right kind of a data sheet, you can select the device that's going to survive that event, let's say, 10,000 times, if that's what you want. So it's not rocket science. This is all calculatable. It is a deterministic situation once you're smart enough, and the laws of physics of inductive and capacitive and resistive circuits are a darn good thing to learn. It'll allow you to calculate by the voltage drop across the 1-ohm resistor when you connect it to a 6.3-volt filament transformer. You can measure exactly how many picofarads or how many farads of capacitance you got. You can measure exactly how many henries you've got on your coil, on your inductor. So these are good things to know, in my opinion. I know that's a partial answer, but at least it puts you down the right one of the right roads to get an answer to your particular question, Rich. You need to fill on any of that? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, let me ask you this. A transorb, is that nothing more than a package of two Zener diodes back-to-back?
If it's an MOV type, I think the answer is not. See, if Glenn's here, he can tell us what's really in a transorb. Is it an MOV or is it back-to-back Zeners? KC2QIQ, if you're available. K2RIW.
Yes, Rich, you got it right. It's basically Zener diodes, but with one... See, typically when we talk about Zener diodes, what we're talking about is usually voltage regulators. You know, it's something that holds a precision or something relatively close to a precision type of voltage. Transorbs generally are not as precision as your typical Zener diode, but they still are solid state just like Zeners. They're not MOVs whatsoever. They're definitely solid state devices. And they're back-to-back, so that basically on an AC waveform, they'll clip in both directions. So you get your positive P-clip, and you'll also get the minus P-clip as well. So whatever you plug it across, just make sure that whatever your peak voltage is, be about at least 150% to 200% higher than that peak voltage, just to make sure that you never start conducting the transorb in a normal mode, if you understand what I'm saying. Let me pass back to Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You got it, Rich.
We got a real slow ID on there. Alright, so I guess if I want to calculate a transorb, I know Carnet says under normal conditions they feed me 122.8. So I should figure 122.8 times 1.414 to get the peak voltage, and then for 200%, I guess double that, and that would be the value of the rating of that I want the transorb to clip at. Am I correct, Glenn?
He said 150% of that one, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay, I thought he said 200%.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yes, basically 152. After 200 volts, the voltage is getting excessive, and then you're allowing it to go higher than it really needs to be. 150, definitely, you don't want to be closer than 150, because then you start getting. You don't want to have an event that'll happen where the thing will start conducting in a normal type of a mode. So you want to be, you know, at least 150 of the peak. So the 200 is also good. And then, of course, keep in mind that the last rating you have to worry about is power. How much power you're going to have to dissipate. So you can figure out the current through the transorb, the whatever that current is, and then, of course, that peak voltage of whatever that transorb is rated for, and then, you know, volt V times I. And then the only other thing you have to know is you have to look at what kind of transients you have. Sometimes if you do it with an oscilloscope and you create the event, you can actually see the spike, its duration. In other words, what you're looking for is the time of how long the spike is, and then, you know, calculate relatively how often that spike takes place, and now you have a duty cycle. and then you can basically say the time on over that total period. So you multiply that by the peak power, and then that's, so in other words, the transorb doesn't have to be the peak power. It can be some power level, you know, much, much less, depending on the duty cycle that it actually has to see. Does that make sense, Rich? N2EO, KC2, QIQ.
Yes, it does, Glenn. I'm going to do a little more research on this. One last thing. Why are they using MOBS? I guess the person who came up with this... See, somebody... W6MAY came up with this mod a number of years ago, and there were a lot of companies like Harmark and others marketing the kit that W6 or K6MAY came up with. So, they're all using these metal oxide baristas that he came up with. Now, I've got it after the fuse, which is what he recommends. What you're saying is the MOBS are no longer legal. Are they not legal in other countries, but legal in the United States? Because you could buy them at Radio Shack, and I could see them setting themselves up for a lawsuit if somebody has a fire.
Well, keep in mind, Rich, whether somebody says that they are or not, if somebody has a piece of equipment and it goes on fire and it's because of some kind of a known type of thing, and your equipment causes a fire, you're liable. So Underwriters has pointed this out, that MOVs are devices that they wear out every time they get hit. So they get a little bit worse every time, and the more times they get hit, eventually they'll wear out. Now, if you've got the type of circuit where every time you operate it, it's going to be going into some kind of limiting of this MOV where it's going to be dissipating power, you're wearing it out. And therefore, you know, through multiple testing, they find out when these things do fail, they short out and they burst. And the package actually explodes if you look at it. For a while, what Underwriters was allowing people to do was to cover them with, like, sleeving. They would take Teflon sleeving, shrink sleeving, and shrink it around the MOV. But even that, after a while, was proven that it would even blow away the Teflon sleeving. So eventually they just came out and said, you know something, from here forward, from this design date forward, do not use the MOVs on circuits. But keep in mind, too, there are a lot of circuits out there, Rich, that sit on the line that are not fused. Or if they might be fused, but to a much higher current level. In other words, back where, like, you have a 15-amp main, but if you had 15 amps running through a shorted MOV, that 15-amp main will never open. So N2EO, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, Glenn. Well, this is sitting on the far side of a 4-amp fuse in the Collins power supply. I just put this in maybe about 10 days or so ago. I take it, well, the MOB looks like a red ceramic disc capacitor. I take it I can substitute a transorb right there. I'm going to use the transorb. What does it look like? And then we'll turn it back to Ned.
The ones I've seen more often, Rich, today, you can get them in surface mounts. Those are most of the ones that I've been using. I have seen them in cases that look like oversized diodes, very monstrous-sized leaded diodes that can go into boards. But there's other packages. I've even seen some packages that look similar to the disc types, like you're explaining over there. But they're rare. As a matter of fact, most likely, if you see a disc, it's more than likely going to be an MOV. So in this particular case, most cases, the most common ones in the high power that you're going to find available, like through Moser or one of the local parts suppliers, you're going to find that it probably looks something very similar to a large metal-cased diode. Let me pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I have the impression you've done quite a bit of work with the transorbs, Glenn. So give me a rough guess. How expensive? Where do I buy them? And the ratings, are they rated for max power dissipation, max current dissipation, max joules of total energy per second or per minute? Is there a joule rating, a current rating, a wattage rating? and a rough guess as to a price and what brand name. KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, actually, the answer is all of the above. Depending on how good the data sheet is from the manufacturer, you'll find that there's, you can find all of those ratings. But for, like, let's say typical amateur use, there's really the one rating that you're going to be interested in, Rich, is the voltage. You're going to be interested in peak voltage, and the other one you're going to be interested in is going to be power. In other words, you'll see like a rating on them, like a Zener diode, you might see rated like 100 milliwatts, and then of course, you know, when you start getting into transorbs, you see numbers like 5 watts, 10 watt is going to be more common. So when you start looking at that, those are power dissipations that you can figure out the peak power that you're going to be dissipating in your transorb, and then just find out what kind of duty cycle, how long that spike takes place, and how many times, you know, how often it's taking place, and then come up with a duty cycle, and then take the peak power times that duty cycle and come up with a power rating. So you're going to want the power rating. The next thing is pricing. They're usually relatively inexpensive from what I found, maybe a couple of dollars, a dollar type of thing for, you know, like a 5-watt type of device. And that's, you know, pretty much what you're going to get, like Mauser type of pricing, you know, or Newark or any of those kinds of places. Certainly if you're buying them by the hundreds or thousands, they're considerably cheaper. You know, you get them for pennies, actually. But here again, you know, for amateur use, you're going to be probably paying a couple of dollars for them. Did I skip anything there, Dick? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'll find them in the Mauser catalog. And do you have a favorite brand name, or are there five different brand names I could be using? And don't worry,
I haven't found one that I've found particularly better than the other. I think they all seem to work quite well. You know, it's you're not worried about like precision regulation. You're only really worried about power dissipation and peak voltage. And when you put this device in your circuit, you know, especially if you look at it with an oscilloscope, it's absolutely amazing what a nice job it does of limiting the spikes. Because in other words, when you see these tremendous spikes, I mean, sometimes they go beyond the voltage capability of your probe. You'd be amazed. You know, you're looking at a voltage probe with like a 400-volt rating, and you start seeing these spikes that are going way off the scale when these things are happening. It's pretty scary looking. And then you put one of these inside, and all of a sudden, wow, it really tames the circuit down nicely.
Okay, I thought about you yesterday while I was driving to Limark to go to the field day operation in Wausau. And the reason I thought about you is two reasons. One, I was hoping you had been there and you and I would have an eyeball. And number two, the automobile that was in front of me had tail lights that were light-emitting diodes. And quite a few things have light-emitting diodes. I think they're being used on traffic lights. But this particular automobile, what struck me about it is that when you're doing a good job of driving at nighttime, you're scanning your eyes from time to time, left to right, to make sure you see what's around you. You want situational awareness. As I scanned my eyes, in my peripheral vision, I was catching the light-emitting diodes on the taillights of this automobile in front of me, and I could see a very distinct stroboscopic effect. In other words, it was obvious to me that the light-emitting diodes were not running in the CW mode. They were running in the pulse mode. And by the way the stroboscopic effect appeared in my vision, in my residual vision, I could tell that they're on 10% of the time and off 90% of the time. And I'm guessing that the pulsing of the light-emitting diodes is done in order to get higher efficiency out of them in lumens per watt. And so I wonder if anyone's had any discussions yet about the stroboscopic effect and what that could do to some people's vision. I imagine by making a rough estimate as to how fast my eyes were scanning, I could make a guess as to how fast they were being pulsed, and I would make a guess they were being pulsed at 200 times per second. Just a very rough guess. Any words you've got along those lines that would be appreciated, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
2 Zetical Alpha. Oh, yeah, Kawaii.
Both Glenn number 2 and Joe recognized, but Glenn number 1, QIQ, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, actually a lot of research has been done in that area. One, for efficiency reasons. T2 is the temperature, thermal rise of the, because in other words, where these things are located, they're located in areas where you don't want to dissipate a lot of heat. So you want to keep the lifetime expectancy as high as you possibly can. And the other thing that's happening too is that there's a lot of research being done on LEDs and damage to the eyes. So in other words, when people are looking at it, to make sure that the correct filters in front of the LED disperse the light enough, and then of course the amount or the rate at which they're being pulsed is enough to make the eye aware of that, especially with a hazard light like a stoplight, that it stands out, but that the heating effect on the retina is at such a low enough level at a certain distance that it doesn't cause eye damage. So all of the above are actually are not in definite research right now, and a lot of it is understood, though, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
N2ZEA, go ahead, Glenn, K2RIW, and after that we're going to go to Joe. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I'd just like to say that I find it extremely disorienting and annoying when you do that. You scan your eyes across the road, it looks like multiple vehicles in front of you for a split second, and I really think it's bordering on dangerous. I don't like it.
Okay, I see where you're coming from. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, go right ahead.
To my original question, you've been talking about transorbs and as a suggestion of me using that, of course, to switch to take care of the arcing effect, the apparent arcing effect. I understand 150% of the peak voltage is what I'm looking for, but nobody mentioned how much wattage. You said I have apparently 0.4 joules of energy. What would you suggest for a wattage rating of that device? What I'd be looking for?
Okay, the way a inductive kickback device works, it tries to maintain the current. The in the case of capacitor, there's two rules about reactive devices. You cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. You cannot instantaneously change the current through an inductor. So since the current through the inductor, you've already measured it at 2.7 amperes, and that's RMS current. The peak is 1.414 times that. I'm going to round it off in my head and say it's 3 amperes. Since we know that 3 amperes could be flowing through your inductor when loco goes through 0 volts, we know that, therefore, the inductive kickback, that inductor tries to maintain that current. Therefore, it's attempting for some number of microseconds, it's attempting to generate exactly 3 amperes of current in the opposite direction. 3 amperes at 120 volts is something like 350 watts. So the peak wattage for a very brief period of time, the peak wattage will be 350 watts. The total amount of energy in that reverse pulse is going to be 0.4 joules. I think you've got it all. And the numbers we've come up with, maybe you're a little bit pessimistic, because by the time it kicks back to the opposite polarity and generates that 2.7 amperes RMS, 3 amperes peak, I calculated very roughly here, there's going to be a little bit of a fall off. It's going to be a little bit less than that. But it looks like peak wattage would be 350 watts. I wonder if anyone disagrees with that before I pass it back to Joe. Back to Joe with a little bit of delay. K2RIW.
This is K2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. You know, as a person that likes to cannibalize things that I find, especially in the street, the monitors, they throw out a lot of monitors. A lot of them are fairly large screen ones now. I see, like, 20-inch, 21-inch monitors, big babies being thrown out. And I pulled a number of chassis out of them. And on the input, they have this box. And the box, what exactly is that box there? Is it just some kind of line filters, or is it also to absorb spikes? Or what exactly is these monitors all have that box that's around 2.5 inches or so square, Dick, over?
EMI filter.
Yeah, is this the little box where the three-prong plug for the wire that goes into the wall, that three-prong plug goes into the back of the monitor? Is that the thing you're describing, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, approximately. differently. Some of them have the three-pronged plug that plugs in there. Others have, it's mounted separately on a plate or whatever, or a couple of rivets or screws. And there's two wires in, two wires out, of course. And I was wondering, what exactly is just a line filter, or is there anything else to absorb any kind of abnormalities on the line surges, or what exactly does it really absolutely, meant to do, basically take over?
KC2QAQ?
You got it, Glenn.
Mel, this is an area where I can give you a lot of information on. As a matter of fact, the first thing that filter box is doing is it has to meet FCC Part 15. It can't have emissions that are conducted onto the power line. So you're going to find a power line filter inside there to meet conducted emissions. That also is going to help out a lot with radiated emissions, but its main life function is conducted emissions to meet the FCC standard. Now, being that the FCC is the governing body when you're selling devices within the United States, and there are also other ones, you can use the IEC standards when it's sold overseas, because now these things are like international voltages and everything. The second part of that is, yes, there also is surge devices inside there as well, because part of those other standards that have to be met as well is surge spikes and transient waveforms that thing definitely has to take care of on the power line. Let me pass it back to Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Almost every good piece of test equipment has one of those connectors on the back panel that you plug the line cord into. So there's the line cord is male on the end that goes into the wall, and it's female on the end that goes into the back of the instrument. Almost every one of them have that. And the EMI function, I believe. What percent of them do you think also have a transorb function? Glenn, go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, I think most of the ones that Mel have right now, he's probably looking at, are probably 5 years and older. And you're going to probably find MOVs inside of them still, because this whole thing has only been coming up within the last couple of years. And originally, you could find all kinds of devices inside there. There's discharge gas tubes that they were using for a while inside there that were basically little arc-over devices. They got eventually kicked out. Then everybody said to use MOVs. They were using MOVs for a while. Now the transorb devices are more common. But I would imagine that more than likely inside that one, that the monitor, the older monitors that Mel is looking at, well, hopefully it's going to be some combination of MOVs and spark apps. KWC2Q.
Got any further questions on that one, Mel?
No, the monitors are not that old. Believe it or not, you've seen stuff thrown out now that, used to look to be, stuff that was, as you would say, oh boy, electronics is ancient. But since the flat screens have been, coming in really strong, I've got a couple of them here that I just couldn't break up. There was nothing wrong with those monitors. The picture on them is phenomenal. And being I like CRTs more than I like these so-called flat screens, I have kept them, and I looked at the date, and some of them are actually no more than maybe 2 years old. So I wonder, within that period, is there a possibility? Now, the monitors are rated, they show that they're rated like 350 watts. I didn't think they use that much power, but many of them I see marked on the rear, consumption. 350 watts of power. So I assume that that's another reason that they go over to, these flat screens, because maybe you could cut your electric bill sufficiently if you're using it, continuous or over quite a bit of the day for commercial use. But I was just curious if that is a viable, a little device that you can easily find and stick it in the line if it would be beneficial to be used in something like Rich's power supply, Dick, over.
Yep, understand. Joe's degaussing coil and Rich's power supplies. So, Glenn, are UOVs being removed from the bubble packs at Radio Shack, or could a naive person continue buying them for the next 5 years, even though the authorities are starting to recommend you don't use them? Is there any authority attempting to remove them from availability? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Dick, I don't suspect that you're going to see them removed anytime soon, and I think what's really happening is that their usage is being put into a different category. In other words, the application of being used on power lines is what's outlawed. It's not the device itself that's being outlawed, it's how it's being used. You can use MOVs in a lot of situations where they're not going to be that harmful. You can put them in circuits with resistors and diodes and a whole bunch of interesting circuits where you can create a soft limiting device where it's not going to explode and cause problems. The kind of problem that with the MOV in the power line situation is that you're getting surges and spikes that are happening randomly. And depending on your location and where you're getting your AC power, if you start getting hit with a whole bunch of them in a row, your MOV starts to fail. Now the breakdown voltage of the MOV is dropping. So where before it might have been a 375-volt part, now it's down to, you know, like a 240-volt part. And guess what? If you're running it on 220, it's already breaking down. And eventually it starts dissipating, it starts getting hot, and eventually it just explodes and goes on fire because there's nothing really to limit it. Because even if you have a fuse in front of it, chances are the current that the MOV is going to need to explode and go on fire isn't going to be enough to blow the input fuse yet. You know, it's not going to go to a short circuit first. It's going to go to a high power dissipation state before it actually, goes on fire and melts down. And that's when these things actually, like the cases literally explode, and it looks like little grenade gunfire inside, and with smoldering hot, ash going all over components inside that can start fire. So that's probably the issue. It's the application, not the not necessarily the device itself that's evil. It's just where, don't use it on a power line with a power source that's not limited where it can cause trouble.
WS2N, question on this MOV, Dick.
Yeah, I have the impression that if it's on the far side of a fuse, it might be okay. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I'm listening to this topic on and off all night. MOV, can you tell me what that stands for? What does it look like? Is it a box? Or is it a circuit that you buy? What are we talking about here? Some kind of transformer? Zener diode? What are we talking about there?
It looks like a fat disc ceramic capacitor with two leads coming out of the perimeter of the disc ceramic capacitor. So it looks like a very fat disc ceramic capacitor. And when you look inside of these surge protector type multi-plug connectors that many people used to buy for their computer, where, you have one plug in the wall and now you can plug five things into it. Your monitor, your computer, and your printer, and so on. If you look inside of those, you see these great big fat disc ceramic capacitor-like things. They are, in many cases, MOVs, metal oxide varistor. Back to you, Paul.
Oh, okay. So they would be inside the unit itself. It's not something that you're plugging into. Okay. Very good. Metal oxide varistor?
You got it. If you actually took it apart under a microscope, you'd see a whole bunch of little fine granules that are presenting what you and I would call a whole lot of microscopic spark gaps. So the way the thing works is that when you exceed its rated voltage, it literally arcs across those spark gaps inside. And the good news is it'll absorb the energy. The bad news is your individual spark gaps are slowly being consumed in the process. So the thing, if you're hitting it a significant amount of energy, significant number of times, the thing continuously changes its characteristics. And in many cases, it goes to lower and lower voltages as you start arcing over more and more of those individual spark gaps that are microscopically set up in that material. Is that approximately the way it works, Mel? Here we go. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yes, absolutely, Dick. That's exactly what's going on. And I think where the safety agencies have really, beaten up on these MOVs on power lines, to get them out of circuits and don't use them anymore, is because they were finding out that the amount of damage that can be caused because of the device slowly breaking down like that, basically it's almost like having a Zener diode that literally starts lowering in voltage over time. And as it gets lower and lower, it may start drawing current at a knee point where it starts getting very, very hot, but not enough power to blow a fuse yet. And then when it finally goes, it comes apart in literally in a very, very terrible manner. And we're actually, I've seen them so explode so bad, they look like almost like little grenades going off with smoldering, melting objects going onto other components and wires and melting through other circuits. Really, really horrible damage that happens from these things. But, basically, it's exactly as you described. It's a slow breakdown period. And initially, the theory was that why they were thought to be a good device for surge was that people never realized how often things see these high surges, because people are using very, very high voltage ranges, because they figured, okay, if you use like a 2 kV, what they call level 2 surges, which are 2 kilovolt spikes, they figured, these don't really happen all that often. It's just the little occasional lightning strike here and there, but the reality is they happen a lot more often on power lines than people really want to realize, and it causes a tremendous amount of failure, and depending on what the location, sometimes in one neighborhood, the power line might be very, very quiet. But then again, you might have a neighbor next door who does a lot of drilling and uses high power equipment. His equipment's going on and off all the time, and these surges are much more common than people would imagine. Washer and dryers turning on and off, electric garage door openers going up and down. It's amazing how many things cause power line surges and ring waves on power lines. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
Then 2EO.
Go ahead, Rich.
2EA.
Rich, and then Ed in that order. Rich first.
Okay, simple question. How do you spell transorb? I guess it's TRANSZORB. I'm gonna scan it on Mauser, because I happen to order some parts from them tonight anyway. I have an account with them. I was gonna say to Glenn or you, Dick, I assume I can, the way that Maud told Abby put a barista across the neutral and the far end of the fuse, I could just substitute a transorb there and I'd probably be safe. And I guess seeing that I put that Maud in only a week ago, it's no big deal at this point. It takes time to break down, am I correct? In other words, I shouldn't run down tomorrow morning and clip it out.
You got it, Glenn.
Rich, absolutely. I would not, it's not like one of those things where, I feel that, it's going to instantly happen. It's just one of those things where when you put a safety device inside a system like an MOV, you're putting it in there because you're like, something, I'm putting this in here just in case so I don't have this long-term failure. But no one in the world wants to put something in where you're going to put it in, forget about it, and 2 years later you open it up and go, oh my God, what happened inside here? That's the device I put in there to protect something? It's more along those kinds of lines, if you understand what I'm saying. N2EO, KZ2QIQ.
Okay, Glenn, now I could just put a transorb right in this place, and I assume when I go on Mauser, because I do everything online, TRANSZORB.
Just forget the Z, TRANSZORB. No, there's no Z, Rich. Let me pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
I think Ed wanted to make a comment. Mr. EAV, go right ahead.
When MOVs came out in the 70s, they said they have a limited life, and there were some suggested circuits, including among some other components, something like a neon lamp, that they said it would work for a certain number of hits, and then it would short out, which would then not light the neon lamp, so you know that the unit was defective. Apparently, that kind of got forgotten, I guess. In any event, the transorbs, and are you sure there's no Z in there, Glenn? I've worked with them. It's like a 1.5 PA number. I kind of remember a Z, but I must admit it's been a while. Back to Dick.
You got it, Glenn.
No, there's no Z. T-R-A-N-S-O-R-B. As a matter of fact, I even looked it up really quickly here on Wikipedia just to make sure I was giving you the guys the right spelling and everything. That's all it is. And as a matter of fact, they give you some pretty rich, anybody who's interested in using these, there's a very, very good little article even here on Wikipedia. On, if you Google Wikipedia for Transorb, T-R-A-N-S-O-R-B, and there's a couple of good little notes on there and things about them. So, and they are very nice direct replacements for most MOV applications. And as far as the other circuits, in a lot of commercial equipment or in ham radio equipment, most people don't look for lights going off inside. And, there's something about, you know, putting a safety device inside a system where you really want it to be able to take a hit and keep on coming kind of a thing. Or if something does happen, it's a fuse that kind of opens, and then you know that all the power's off. In other words, it always fails in some... if you're going to have a failure in a very safe mechanism. Off is a very safe mechanism, so if a fuse blows or a circuit breaker opens, off is good. Lights on and still functioning, I'm not sure that's really good. So I kind of have to agree more with, like, UL and what, you know, how they've kind of went about this. Let me pass it back to Dick, and so K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Dick, one quick question about the MLV.
Go ahead, Paul, and then I'm going to pass it to Ed if he has any further comment. Paul first, WS2N.
Okay, maybe you or Glenn know. If I have to find one of these in one of my pieces of equipment here, when these things fail, does it present an open circuit where now the unit won't work? Or is it just shorted? In other words, the unit will still work, but this thing won't be functioning and possibly explode.
It's usually used in shunt with the 110-volt line. Therefore, when it becomes a short circuit, it starts drawing a ridiculous amount of current and creating a ridiculous amount of heat. Let's see if Glenn gets any further words on that. QIQ?
Yeah, exactly, Dick, and Paul. If it's failing or failed, you won't need anything to point in the direction of what failed or what went wrong, because it will definitely mark its spot. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
You got a poll for any follow-up?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds terrible. Awful. What about fusible links? I mean, you know, isn't that the way to go? I mean, that used to be a big thing in cars. Annoying, you know, you have to change the whole thing out. You couldn't just change a fuse, but, you know, fusible link that would fail.
I don't think that's a great solution, because the fusible link is going to blow open when the MOV has a certain level of failure. But there's a magic zone in there where you're not drawing quite enough current to blow the fusible link, but the current you're drawing at 110 volts AC still represents a ridiculous amount of watts, and therefore the heating inside the MOV is taking place. I don't think an MOV can dissipate more than 2 watts without eventually exploding. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, I can't say that I'm the expert in this area, but I can say that from what the underwriters' documents and the other world bodies that have been studying this and some of the documents that I've read, it gets ugly. And there again, there's so many different sizes of MOVs. Which you can get very, very small ones that are like little 11-millimeter discs. You get them to like 17 millimeters. And then they have these monstrous ones that go up to the size of hockey pucks. And for huge, huge, huge power circuits, and some of the pictures that I've seen of the failure mechanisms of these devices, very, very scary. It looks like they cause more damage than the surge would have.
Let me give you a similar story. The scene is 1985. Airborne Instruments Laboratory, where I had been working, was the major producer of the electronics on the B-1 bomber. The B-1 bomber contains 105 LRUs, LRU stands for Line Replaceable Unit. That's the Air Force word for the boxes that you can unplug from the aircraft when you want to replace something. The Navy has their equivalent.